Oh, welcome back to It Feels Right with Rob and Stone. And yes, Stone is back in the studio this week. We are going to talk a little bit about the tip of the week, how we both have beautiful hairlines, and why variety is so important in pickleball.
And of course, a recap of the Veolia Austin Open. And I think our tip of the week is going to play into some of the big matches that you saw this past weekend.
Let's get after it.
Because you know why?
Why?
Because it feels right.
It feels right. Legendary.
Ladies and gents, before we hop into the show, I do want to talk to you a little bit about Selkirk's amazing line of pickleball nets. And whether you're just starting out or you're a seasoned pro, Selkirk has the perfect net for you. When you choose a Selkirk net, you're not just choosing any net, you're opting for the official net of the PPA Tour, where excellence meets professional play. With Selkirk's line of nets, you can play pickleball anywhere. Selkirk's range of nets caters to every player's needs, offering budget-friendly choices for casual enthusiasts and premium options for those with a competitive edge that are looking for more of the pro-level net. So either way, you're ensuring quality play for all levels, and I've got a Selkirk net for myself, and let me tell you, it's a game changer. It's all about playing on your terms wherever you are, whether it's the driveway or on the PPA Tour. So if you love pickleball as much as I do, and we do here at It Feels Right podcast, check out Selkirk's pickleball nets. Get the freedom to play anywhere and everywhere and elevate your game with the net trusted by the pros. Selkirk's got you covered. If you're interested in getting a net of your own, go to selkirk.com/collection/nets, and we'll link to that in the show notes. You can also find this link in the description of the show. But let's jump into this week's episode of It Feels Right with Robin Stone. Oh, Adam, that's a nice smile. It's a nice beard too. And you know, I don't like it, but look at, we always start on talking about each other's appearance to start, but yeah. I like your hair a little bit longer like that. I don't know what Prof thinks, but I prefer it a little longer. I prefer kind of like the untrimmed beard look, the salt and pepper. So I like what we're doing this morning. I missed you last week. We had, you know, Greg Dowd did his best to fill in, but I'm happy to see you're back, and I'm happy to be doing this Monday morning little breakfast sesh with you.
Well, I really appreciate all of that, Robert, but Prof likes none of it. So I need a haircut. I'm very hairy right now, just all over. So Rob, it's hard to do simple things sometimes when you have a young child. So just making a trip 7 to 8 minutes to Great Clips or Sport Clips or wherever I normally go is just, it's just tougher. So I'm about 24 days late on my haircut, and here we are. I mean, I think it looks okay given the circumstances though.
Yeah. I respect that you show your hair. Like, I've got a nice set of hair for my age, and I've had the same issue with Great Clips, but what I've started to do this online check-in thing to check the wait times. Dude, there's nothing worse than going to a Great Clips or like a Supercuts and just like sitting in the waiting area for 25 minutes, 30 minutes. I'd rather do anything else.
I've like come around on the tech age a little bit the last couple years, but there's just something about getting on the wait list that I just can't do it. So a lot of times I end up walking in and then walking out because they have the little estimated wait time at like 36 minutes or something. It's not an option. It's not an option. And it's you get a motley crew in some of those places. You get a wide variety of people sitting there with you in the waiting room at Fantastic Sam's, Great Clips or Sport Clips. So it's a scary place sometimes.
And look, I've had a run of where I've been like, you know what? I'm done with Great Clips. I'm done with Supercuts. I'm going to spend $50 on a haircut. And then, you know, they're going to give me like a moist towelette and just like, you know, I've honestly been offered a glass of champagne. I'm like, this is nice. But the haircuts haven't been like significantly better than Great Clips or Supercuts. So I'm like, why am I doing this? Like, it's an aggressive amount of money for a haircut.
Yeah, it is. No, I understand. And I've tried that as well. Maybe a little tingling shampoo or a little warm towel massage up top. But it does seem like I'm expecting an earth-shattering haircut, and it has yet to happen.
Yeah.
But I will toot both of our horns. Normally, it's just mine that I'm tooting. But I think given you know, our accelerated ages, our hairlines are looking pretty good. Like, I think we might be safe from some, you know, male pattern baldness, but you never know. It can strike at any time.
It can, but you know, it's the mom's side. It's the mom's dad, right?
And yeah,
I think I'm, you know, from what I know, it's a pretty full head of hair, so we should be good.
Yeah. Great start, Robert. We're really rocking it here.
Well, you know, I do want to mention something because you went back to back commentary, Minneapolis to Austin, and there's, you know, I don't always know who's commentating, and one of the issues is that they never say their name, so it's never like I'm always like wondering like who's talking right now. So I wonder why names aren't put on the screen just so we know who's commenting, and they are like they're like a brief glance of it, but then nobody ever says like who they are. I think people forget, like the commentators forget like to say their name so we know who's actually talking. It feels like, well, a big piece that's missing.
Well, I think when it's Dave and I, we normally do.
Yeah, you guys are good.
Yeah,
and
your
voices are more well known.
Yeah, so maybe it could be because sometimes they have a little you know, a few different people on grandstand or a possible fill in for a fourth, because we've had some different people doing it. So it's Michelle, myself, and Dave. And then that fourth person has kind of been, you know, some Matt Manassi, Daniel Roditi, a handful of others. And then on grandstand, you have the player. But I agree on tuned into grandstand. I'm like, who is that? And it is a bit interesting. I think we had Marcel Chan and a variety of other players, especially on singles day over on grandstand court. So a little graphic, a little say who you are. That's what they say in the ear. Identify yourself.
I mean, it's important.
And the graphic pops up and then we talk about it. So yeah. And shout out to Dave. He always gives me the, my man, Adam Stone. And you know, I appreciate that. So,
yeah. How was Austin?
Oh, well,
the rain.
I mean, some very quality matches and some different matchups as well. But the rain was rough that last day. I mean, we had the ladies at one site playing. We had the top half of the fellas draw at Dreamland. And then like midway through the day, we were able to get because we had a window from 5 to 7 p.m. for FS2. And we wanted to do live pickleball for that, so we ended up going back to the venue, had a small window of dry courts, but it was rough. So Dylan Seeger is kind of the player liaison or director of player affairs, whatever his title is, and man, he had a rough day. He was directing traffic, you know, all the players. I mean, they have their routines, and you know, they like to practice here. They like to eat a little snack here. They like to do this. And when it's chaos like that, I can only imagine how tough his job is with three different sites trying to get it done. And it looked go ahead.
No, I was going to say props on getting a stream up at Dreamland last minute. You know, that's it was a different angle, right? Seeing low to the court. And I just thought, I didn't expect to see a stream, but it was nice. It was nice they got it up. I was hoping to see more Altoff play, but you know, can't get everything.
You can't get everything. We were like two courts away, or Michelle and Matt Manassi were like two courts away calling the action from this little booth. And then we had, I mean, the crew's ridiculous. Like, I mean, you guys don't understand what goes into some of these streams. I mean, wires everywhere. Like they got generators to power it and all this other stuff. So some of the days the crew puts together are ridiculous, like 14-hour days. They got to get there hours early, they got to stay hours after. So I was a bit shocked that they were able to just pull the trigger on Dreamland and get a stream up as well, but good job, boys and girls.
And you know, Dreamland's owned by Steve Kuhn, so props to Mr. Kuhn for being kind and providing the facility.
That's right. And he was there for a couple hours that day. I was not able to talk to him or I didn't see him or talk to him, but just given the last 6 months or whatever, maybe some people might think Dreamland was not an option. Well, it was, and it worked out nicely. And according to Deckel, who I stayed with in Austin. He's pretty comfortable with the facilities around. I think there was an option to go to Bastrop, which is a little outside of Austin, but Deckel said that Dreamland was the best option for pro pickleball, indoors or under a cover. So I was glad we were able to get some matches in there.
Yeah, for sure. What were your thoughts? So I saw some mixed messaging on at the main site, the court coloring. It obviously was like a grayish, like a gray and a charcoal, like a darker gray. I've always felt like with the gray courts and the white lines that it makes it tough to actually call balls and see balls very well. And I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I kept looking up and thinking I was watching the stream in black and white for a second, especially if the players were wearing like white shirts, black shorts. It's like, so I don't think I'm a very big fan of the that color scheme, but I do like the idea. Thank you. I do like the idea of switching court colors at different places and making it based like doing a color scheme based on whatever city it's in or whatever stop it's at.
No, I think that that's reasonable. And I don't know about functionality in terms of looking. I didn't hear anything about it, but I kind of like the gray, how it just looks now.
I heard it looked great in person, but on the stream, that wasn't so great.
Oh, maybe so.
Like it on the stream, but I heard in person, it looked awesome.
Minnesota, there was gray as well. I don't know if it was like kind of double gray like it was in Austin, but in person looks clean. And I didn't hear anything otherwise about possibly on the stream or calling the balls in or out. But I think that could be a cool idea to, you think of like Boise State for football or something like that. You know, you have a special color scheme given where you are in the country or for a specific event. Yeah, I think that could add a little something to it. And there's probably, I can't think off the top of my head, there's probably a couple colors or courts I've played on that I was like, this affects play a little bit. But some of the variety, I think for the most part, doesn't really matter that much to the players. I would like to see that. I think it could be cool. I think the idea of whatever it is, you know, MLP teams associated with a location or a tournament that has something special that, you know, year after year people could kind of recognize or whatever, I think is a reasonable step to take.
Yeah, I like that too. And I hope MLP moves to kind of, you know, the city-based teams having like a local home venue, whether or not you necessarily play matches out of there. I think not so much this year, right? Because we've got the MLP stops and they're kind of in conjunction with the PPA stops, but having like a home facility, doesn't have to be your facility, but you know, where you partner with a local facility that, you know, does your branding on court, maybe does some color scheme on court, would be super cool. I've been spending some time up, and I think I mentioned this to you, up in Bristol, Tennessee, where they actually just had the Food City 500 Let's Go NASCAR this past weekend, Bristol Motor Speedway. But I've been spending some time up there. I'm using it as a home base in between tournaments and in between when I'm not in Florida and Jacksonville. But in terms of color schemes, they're building a beautiful outdoor venue. They're going to have a PPA tournament in August, which is going to be a lot of fun. So hopefully that draws a lot of people to the Bristol area. Cause I mean, they're working really hard on it already. It's, what is it? Mid-March. This tournament's in mid-August and they're already like, you know, drumming up ticket sales and getting a lot of people pumped on it. So I think that's also like a direction that would be cool to go, is going to these kind of smaller cities where pickleball, you don't get high level pro pickleball in that area. It just makes it so much more exciting than hosting something in Austin where all the pros live, or hosting something in Mesa, which sees a tournament every other weekend. And I think going to these places like Bristol and like some of the smaller cities that have nice facilities, like this place is going to have a beautiful facility. They're going to have a stadium court built in. It's going to be really, really nice. So finding like those locations that are a bit of a smaller city or town that has beautiful facilities makes it really exciting, because then players, it's kind of like the Beer City effect, where you go to Grand Rapids and they're so stoked because they don't get a lot of pro pickleball coming through there. And this is like their one event per year where they can really rally around the tournament. And I think Bristol is going to be like that. And that's, I think that's, that should be the direction of, like, on the tour side.
Yeah, I think that that's very reasonable, Rob, as you would think the hotbeds, of course, we're going to get more numbers, more people, more fans, but it's almost, you know, I mean, you know, when the PPA rolls in, or, you know, when the pros come in, I mean, it sure, it's different. But when you do have a legitimate local tournament every other weekend, or some type of pickleball to view, I mean, they have like the Arizona MLP League down there, Peoria Pythons or whatever it is. So there's stuff to watch. But yeah, you go to Bristol, or you go to, I don't know, like St. George, or one of those places that's a little bit lower key. Beer City Open was a perfect example. Like, there's real buzz, and that's our shot to play a tournament like this year. And I think there is a different excitement to it in some of the smaller locations.
Yeah, I agree. You get because they're trying to drum up economic activity, right? So like a pro tournament coming into their smaller town is a big deal, and they put more resources behind it. And already been talking about like what we can do in Bristol for the August PPA. And so Bristol, Tennessee, but it's right on the Tennessee Virginia state line, the border. So, and their main street's called State Street, and the southern part, so like the storefront's right, it's like a typical main street in a town or a city. And the storefronts on the bottom half are all Tennessee. The storefronts on the other side of the street are all Virginia. So
that's cool.
Even talking about setting up a pickleball united or pickle roll court right there, and like having the net be kind of the state line, and then having one team in Virginia, you know, and then the other team in Tennessee, like just doing fun stuff like that. So yeah, I think it's really cool having smaller cities host PPAs, host different tournaments, because it's a real excitement, and the cities usually really rally behind it, more so than you could get like, you know, a typical tour stop or larger city.
Yeah. And I think it's, from what I've noticed, is you get a variety of different types of crowds too. And what I mean by that is just like overall energy or frequency of getting excited about good. Like, you'll go to some stops and there's, sure, all the crowds are pretty decent and pretty solid, but some tour stops you'll get this amazing point, and you'll get, you know, get some golf claps and maybe one lady with a sign going crazy or something like that. And then you go to different stops and you can feel a different energy, like that, like every point is exciting and riveting, and that translates to on court, or at least did for me. When I'm playing in front of a legit crowd, not just numbers, but like the intensity that they're bringing to cheering, and man, that really comes down on court in between the lines, and I think makes the product better. And sure, you know, you got a few hundred people there, and you know, they're just clapping, maybe not quite as energetic. You know, I'm not saying, you know, that's affecting my play in a poor way too much, but I think it's more a rise in level when you do have that energy on court, and it just changes day to day and stop to stop. And of course, a lot of these tournaments are starting Thursday with singles, and then the crowds and the energy build through the weekend, and that's just part of the deal. But I think it makes a difference, and some of those energy players down on court, I think, feed off of that, and product's better. When the product's better, it's better for everyone.
Best environment you've ever played in?
Oh, whoa. That's a good question. Actually, you know what? The best environment I ever played in was probably about 6 years ago at Canadian Nationals.
Let's go.
So this is in Kelowna, and a beautiful place.
Yeah, I've only heard it's gorgeous.
This is before things got popping. You know, this is before like tours and anything like that. And there's not even a grandstand or anything. It's just people like 10 people deep surrounding the court. And anytime there was a point better than like a missed serve or a missed drop. Like it was just, oh my goodness gracious. Heaven forbid you get a let cord or something, you know, where the crowd goes crazy. And like you could really, the energy was palpable. And those Canadian folk, they're very nice people and they love their pickle. And I would say that stands up because they didn't have the setup for a big crowd or not a spot that you think you would find the energy, and it was there.
Yeah, that's cool. And that's not what I expected you to say. So I love the fact that it's a throwback where it's like standing room only, and it's just, yeah. And I think there've been many attempts at having kind of the pro tour stops in Canada, but we've been, you know, it's been canceled most times, I think a couple times due to COVID and tougher border crossings, but hopefully we can get a tour stop in Canada. And I think they're just ripe. I think it's ripe for action. And I think they're going to be super excited once a tour stop does come there.
Okay. And I agree completely yep. with you. Last one is very first PPA in Mesa, Arizona. It was kind of like duskish evening, and it was a very, just for like, the number of people, which was, it was several hundred for sure. But I just think like the energy per person was pretty dang high for that initial event. And that one sticks out as well. And I think when you do start creeping later in the day and possibly even a night match, there's definitely a different energy. It's like, I always think of, like, you know, you've been at the venue all day, maybe it's 12 or 14 hours as a fan. It's like that like sleepover deliriousness that you get, you know, at the end of the night, like you're a little more giggly, you're a little more intense with your cheering and some of your excitement for what's going on. And I've been in that type of scenario several times. And I think that also translates into a good vibe on court.
I totally agree. I think night matches it's a super big deal in terms of environment and atmosphere. I think all championship matches should be played in the evening. I don't know how you do it. Maybe you do like one of the doubles days, you just finish the tournament out that evening. And then you do, you know, you start at 7 PM or whatever it might be, or dusk, on a Sunday, and just do, you know, Sunday night championship. I think, you know, being on prime time, I think you might, I don't know if you lose the crowds because people aren't playing and people leave the amateurs playing. I think you could actually sell tickets and fill up stands like this, you know, make it a fun environment where you have a bunch of night matches. I think that'd be super fun.
Yeah, I like that. So like a later a tournament that just whatever, the stream starts at 3 p.m. instead of 11 a.m. or something like that. And I know I talked about the energy later in the day, but yeah, some people don't want to stay there for 12 hours also. So, but I think if it was a special thing or a specific event that you had those later start times and the night matches, you know, for possibly the last three or four matches of the day could be something that I like and I'm into. So if anybody's listening, think about that.
So Adam, it didn't look like there was just rain in Austin this weekend, but it also looked pretty windy. What were the conditions like? And do you think this should be the catalyst to make pro pickleball go fully indoors?
It's the dreaded inconsistent wind. That's really the killer, you know, and I talk about it on the broadcast all the time because it's so important. It could be 15 miles per hour, one direction the whole time. And that is just easier for the players than 7 or 8 miles per hour where it's just nothing and then kicks up. So, and you know, we're getting bigger and better championship courts. You got the video boards and the stands and stuff. So it's kind of in a little, it's like a little wind tunnel a little bit. And those structures block the wind, but sometimes it stops it. And then like a little gust will swoop in there and kind of change the contact point. And you can, I mean, you know, I know I have a trained eye. I mean, watching racket paddle sports forever, but you can see the difference of cleanliness when it's indoor outdoor. Like it's there, they're set, they're in their athletic position, they're about to hit the ball, and then it jumps 3 inches on them and they kind of lunge at it and maybe bounce it before the net. you just don't really see that indoor as often. So maybe faster play, and maybe you get some shorter points at times indoor, but the balance and the control of the player and what their body looks like at contact is much more consistent indoors than it is outdoors. So it was a big factor with some bounces and some just ball takes off on you. Sometimes it just sits up and then it moves that inch or two to kind of make it a poor shot. And, you know, that's just part of the deal. But, you know, clean play, indoor play is clean play. And I can't really disagree with you there, even though I like both.
Yeah. And I think I kind of equate it to everything comes back to Caitlin Clark and Iowa women's basketball. And I hate to do this, but you know, that's where all roads lead to. And so they did an exhibition at the beginning of the year, but they did it in their football stadium for women's basketball. 55,000 people, they sold out 55,000 people outside. But I guess, you know, when we usually compare pickleball outdoors to other sports, it's usually like tennis or something like that, where but just think about that. Like, think about like field goal percentages of call it a 40-50% field goal percentage team indoors. Outdoors, that's going to drop 5-10% just because of wind, because of conditions. And that's a heavy ball. That's basketball is a heavy ball. So to, you know, think about pickleball outdoors with such a light ball, it's such a big difference of quality of play. And it's just cleaner indoors. Cleaner.
Yeah, light ball. That's very true. I mean, I think everyone used to play, or most everyone used to play random pickup basketball games. And if it's a little breezy and you got those nasty double rims at the park, like you better be shooting layups only. You got no shot. But that's very true. As a heavier ball is going to fly through the air more true. And we have anything but a heavy ball with a wiffle ball and a lot of ways for that thing to move and be manipulated. And with how fast the game is getting, I mean, when that ball's coming at you fast and takes a right turn, like what are you supposed to do? You know, I mean, you can't just, even, you know, the world-class athletes that we have with their hand speed and the reaction time, there's just, I mean, you see how silly everyone looks when it hits the net. Yep. And when it takes a right turn, moving at, you know, 60 or 70 miles per hour or whatever it may be, like, I mean, good luck having extended rallies when the conditions are a certain way. So, I think it'll probably be something that settles at some point, maybe a mix between both. I don't think either one is going to completely go away, even if you might wish that, Robert. But I think it's just something to note, and you just kind of have to realize that when you're watching that tough conditions, tough play, even more impressive what some of the players do.
Yeah, and I think when I think about perfect pickleball venue, I think about honestly, thinking back to like the Columbus MLP, I believe it was at Pickle and Chill. That was epic venue. You had kind of a viewing area from up top on top of the court. You had bleachers on the side. You had kind of like VIP courtside seats. Like, that was just, yeah. So when I think about like kind of the perfect pickleball venue, I think about like a big, really high ceiling indoor space like that, that also has like kind of a built-in stadium court. That to me is like, that's like the pinnacle of pickleball facilities and like the pinnacle of like the fan experience and the player experience, because it's so loud in there. Everything's amplified. And yeah, it's just super fun like that. And I hope somebody out there is building a facility, an indoor facility specifically, with kind of a built-in stadium court, because it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I agree. And I remember that venue. That was actually my last MLP to play. And they had the grandstand, and you could kind of sit the top couple rows and look at both the grandstand court and the championship court. And I don't know, those fans up at the top, maybe because they were watching both, but they were yelling more than normal. And you could really feel that yell. Last week in Minnesota, when there was a crowd eruption on either grandstand or championship, just the fact that it was inside, it just kind of reverberated around the whole facility. And you could, you could tell, and you can, of course, you can hear the cheers and the big points outside as well. But when it is inside, it is a different like audible level, and the decibels go up. And I think everybody feeds on that. It makes the fans want to cheer more. And then, of course, that translates down to the court, like I mentioned earlier.
Yeah. And it's funny that you mentioned, I mean, and we'll get into kind of the regular scheduled programming of the show, which is getting into the tip of the week. But you mentioned your last MLP, Adam. And I think I might have played my last MLP, at least for the foreseeable future. I think players that did do the buyout are eligible to play for prize money. So I think they will be eligible for the draft. But I will not be putting my name in for the draft. I think, as maybe some of you can see, I'm getting my week, every 4 week infusion right now. So battling health stuff, which is super annoying, but it's just part of it. It took a lot out of me playing as much as I played last year. Being sick to the point, like, nobody really understands, like, yeah, how difficult it was or how fatigued I always am. So I'm doing the hard thing, but probably the right thing in terms of prioritizing getting my health in order, or hopefully sorting it out or figuring out the best way to manage it and best way to manage the pain and the fatigue. So no MLP for me. I'm still rehabbing the torn meniscus. It's getting stronger. I'm able to play games and stuff, so that's good. I'm able to move and switch and get to the kitchen without issue. So looking to target a Delray APP return, playing with Eric Lang and Riley Bonert. So that'll be fun. And then US Open after that with Andre Daescu and Susanna Barr. So that's my plan on returning. But yeah, MLP, I'm going the Adam Stone route of, you know, off, you know, outside the lines of drafting and being a GM. And I would love to do that as well. I don't have any necessary prospects, but like, I think I'd be pretty solid in terms of drafting as well as coaching. So that's my shameless plug.
Oh, please. I've done it. It's probably like 20 to one. I've done it to you've done it. So please jump in there. Now that's great to hear that, because I think there was an inkling in your mind when that meniscus happened that maybe that's just it, you know, like, yeah, that was going to be it, just given what are you, 39, 38?
38, yeah.
38. Okay, yeah. So, I mean, these kids are tough, and that's great. You know, not great for the no MLP, but great that you're going to get back on the court for sure in some pro pickleball capacity. So that is a nice little update, Robert.
You know, Adam, it's nice that we can kind of fall back on being high end content influencers and creators. So, you know, here we are.
Yeah, I just never thought I would be so high end at so many things, and you're just right there with me, Ross. So,
here we are,
feeling good about that situation. I like the plug, and I know some teams need help, and I just love that. We're kind of special right now in terms of not many people have retired or stopped playing a certain tour or whatever the case may be. So, you know, in 20 years, there's going to be, you know, hundreds of people that are technically qualified pickleball people. But that's not the case right now. So, So I think it's exciting, and, you know, latching on with the team has been great for me. And I'm looking forward to the next season now that we have some MLP schedule and information. And give a shout to my boy Rob. He's got some quality knowledge.
And 38 events, I'm pretty sure I saw on the schedule between PPAs and MLPs. So it's going to be a packed schedule. I'm sure you're going to be staying busy. And I mean, I think the draft is going to happen in April, early April, I'm guessing. And then first events in Atlanta. So, I mean, MLP, it's exciting that it's back. When I think about kind of my favorite environments in pickleball, like I said, Columbus was really cool. When the Fives were playing in Mesa at the beginning of the year, I think it was last year, that was an insane environment. Even at Dreamland at the final of the very first MLP, like, tight stands, not huge stands, but it was a super fun environment as well. So, glad to see MLP back, and hopefully it still brings that great energy that pickleball needs.
Yeah, I think so. And I know a lot of people are worried about, you know, maybe some dip given the dragging on of the merger and whatever else being, you know, several months instead of a month or two. But I think once everyone gets involved and the product's back out there with some consistency, I don't think it's going to take much, if any, time for the energy to ramp back up. And, you know, I hope I'm right on that. But I think that I am, as it is. Both formats are good. I mean, I don't want a standard tournament. I mean, I've talked about how I really like team play. I don't want a standard tournament to go away. They're great. They're amazing. But I think having both is definitely the optimal situation. And that's the situation that we're in now. And that's fantastic in my eyes.
Yep. Agreed. And there's so many other tangents I could keep going on, but I'm not going to. I'm not. Okay. I'm going to say it once because I said it last week, but you weren't here. And then we'll continue on. But agreed. Regular tournaments are awesome. Mixing up partners would be even more awesome. Let's cap your partner to 5 tournaments a year, and then you have to have somebody new. 5 tournament max. If you want it to be all the top tournaments, the big majors, play with your best partner option there. But other than that, let's force rotations.
No, very, very reasonable. And I think we've, you know, seen some different matchups just from unfortunately a James Ignatowicz situation, a Tyson McGuffin situation who've been out for a couple tournaments, and then just the random skipping of a tournament because how demanding the schedule is for all the tournaments for the athletes. So you get some different variety the last handful of plays, and I think that has created a nice buzz from the pickleball diehards and the people watching the streams and the consumers of the sport to see some variety. And it all for it. Let's go.
Yeah, so talking about kind of the tip of the week, just the tip of the week, is more of like a strategy, more of a strategy tip versus a technique tip or that kind of thing. But one thing we saw in the Zane Navratil, Christian Alshon versus the Johns is – we know the Johns like patterns, right? They prefer a team that's not switching. They prefer if a team's not switching, they know exactly what that pattern is and they can do it over and over. When I mean switching, I mean playing straight up versus stacking. So we saw Zane and Christian play pretty heavy straight up. They stacked in moments, but didn't stack often. And they had Zane on the right sometimes. They had Zane on the left sometimes. And what that does is it removes the go-to pattern over and over. So they're constantly having to adjust what that pattern is and what they want to do based on having a new person on the different side each time. So I think that's an underutilized strategy against the Johns. I think teams that play straight up and can play strongly on both sides is definitely advantageous versus just having the set pattern. Like you see that with J-Dub and Dylan playing the Johns. You know, they get into that same pattern and then they can't get out of it. And the Johns just do it better. Similar game style, but they just do it better. So having the variety and having kind of like, and also Christian did a great job pulling the trigger, especially off the bounce. Ate CJ's lunch, found middle, was really, really impressive stuff off the bounce from Christian. And that's how you have to play. You have to play aggressive. You have to play with trigger pulls, and you have to keep them guessing. Because if they're dictating and dink rallies, you know what's going to happen. You're eventually going to pop one up or leave it a tad high, and they're going to attack you in the exact right spots to make you uncomfortable. So in terms of if you're a player at home, and let's say you are constantly losing to the same team, mix it up. If you've been playing straight up, try stacking. If you've been stacking, play straight up, play both sides. And I think it's a really good reason why you, like, we talk a lot about specialization on one side, only working on the right side and becoming a right side specialist. You've got to have both, especially in men's where you have to play mixed and you need to be good on the left too. So I think that was really eye-opening to me over the weekend watching Zane and Christian play both sides, and it really made the Johns uncomfortable, and I think it paid off and they got the W from it.
Yeah, I like for these tips mixing in some technique and some kind of overall in general theory. And this is even, I like what you said, but I think it's even more obvious at the amateur level who have glaring weaknesses. So if you line up in the same pattern against a team and you know, much more frequently than the pros, the amateur players are going to have one spot or two spots or three spots that you can always go to. That makes it even more important to switch and get out of that, because it could be as easy as, okay, Larry the lobber has a bad backhand dink. When we get to the kitchen, we'll just literally hit every ball there and we'll win. So getting out of that and finding a different way, I think, makes a lot of sense. And there's always been this battle of specialization, like you said, and the flexibility. And why not have the ability to do both and to just, man, things happen so quick out there on the court. When you're just beating your head against a wall in a certain paddle, like in a certain pattern, you're just tapping paddles. That's what you're doing. You're rarely getting out of it in the heat of the moment. You just get squeezed. They get a bunch of points in a row and the match is over. So, you don't want to aggressively go away from that initial game plan, but you have to switch in the moment quicker than you think, because clumps of points in pickleball are just, as much, if not more than most other sports. It can happen so quickly.
Yeah. So does this, and I'm not saying what I'm saying is fact or objective. I think having variety is really important. Obviously, certainly against those top teams that have set patterns, they want to stay consistent and dink. But, against a team like the Johns, I don't know if, it's always talked about as kind of the lefty righty combo is the ultimate combo in pickleball. Like, that's what you want. And I think I would argue that. I would say you want players that are solid on both sides, that can play both sides and not. And basically keep you guessing. I mean, I feel like that's the big key, is to keep your opponent guessing. Especially a team that's just super consistent. It's not going to make a lot of errors. Like, if you're playing a team at home that's just they're a wall, they're a rock, they don't miss much. Like, yeah, give them chaos, give them random speed ups. That's what you want against solid, steady teams, chaos.
Got to get them frazzled. Yeah, obviously the John's Eye are the steadiest and the most structured. So, I always say that on the broadcast. You're not going to grind them into oblivion. That's clearly not an option at this point. So fire away, do some different things. Maybe you go, I know this is a big point of emphasis, but you go high and hard a couple times just to put it in their mind. I mean, this is dang pro pickleball out here. So don't be feeling sorry for anybody. And it really was a well-played match. And I think really the key is the fact that Zane and Alshon can both attack off the bounce to a variety of spots. So Christian Alshon, when he was playing the left, wasn't even hitting backhands. He was running around it, hitting forehands, and he has the athletic ability to crash back to the middle and be where he needs to. And Dave and myself, after the match, talked to his coach, Lee Waters, and that was a point of emphasis. At the kitchen line, trust your athleticism, don't hit backhands, and that is going to – it's not only your better, more consistent soft shot, but that allows him to pull triggers whenever he needs to. And he was doing it – he was stepping all the way out wide and attacking CJ, and he was attacking Ben and the middle of the court when he got a forehand in the middle too. So the off-the-bounce stuff was definitely the difference in that match. And – man, I just kept waiting for their level to dip a little bit, or the Johns to kind of grab a hold of something, and it just didn't happen, even though the score line was obviously very close, especially in game two at 15-13. So great job by them. And Christian, he's got the skill set to take that step into the upper echelon if he's not kind of already there. And Zane played well too. I mean,
they didn't miss much.
The old school, man. These old school guys who, like, oh, they're going to get swept away. They got no shot with the new talent. I mean, these old guys, Andre and Zane, been around forever and just playing phenomenal pickle, and very smart, consistent pickle too. So good stuff there. And, was a great, completely fun match to call as well.
Yeah. And just talking about that, kind of continuing on that tip of the chaos amidst the steady, you have steady with J-Dub and Dylan, and you had Matt and Andre. Matt's obviously very dangerous off the bounce as well. Andre
is going to be very steady, and he's gonna look for the right spots. He's not gonna be too frivolous with speed ups, but he'll do it. And against J-Dub and Dylan, you have to do that too, right? Because they're kind of another version of the Johns, of just being super steady, having great hands, leaving a little high. They have good attacks in the right spots. So to beat them again, you have to be aggressive, and you have to take chances off the bounce. And you obviously have Matt, who's going to be loud and in your face, and probably put the kids in a little bit of a shell. I mean, it's his best shot against them in terms of like actual shots. He's like a couple come ons right into their face. Let's go. A little stare down, a little like slow walk to the net as, you know, just lingers. It's right on cue, dude. And it's how him and Riley used to get after them. And, I mean, great result by those guys. They got pickled in the first game and then beat them pretty handily in the next two. So
yeah.
Good stuff.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, they have plenty of fire in their belly, J-Dub and Dylan, but they're nice kids, you know. They're nice kids. They're well mannered. They're kind of, you know, a little more mild with their personalities. And when you're in your damn mid-40s like Matt is, you better be using everything that you have at your disposal to get wins. Yeah. And dang, he's still getting it done. Wild result for him. And, you know, he's got the hand speed, he's got the mental warfare, and you know, you got to have it all when athleticism is lacking, not from not having it, but just from flat out age.
Dude, I think the win, the championship in Austin for those two guys is purely based on them. Well, not purely, but I think a big piece of it is they're probably two of the best competitors in pro pickleball, in my opinion. I think Matt's right up there in terms of like wanting to win, finding ways to win. And Andre, I mean, you've seen what he's been able to do basically in any tournament he plays, whether it's an APP or whether it's a PPA or MLP. I mean, no matter where that guy plays, he's getting W's. So I think amazing coming out party for him. I hope he gets the respect that he deserves now, because you see he wins on every tour he plays. It doesn't matter. Big, just great weekend for those guys. We're in a unique position, Adam, because we're recording here Monday morning, and due to the rain and everything, a championship Monday this week at the PPA. So we got a good lineup of matches today, and Andre's right there in the mix final too, filling in for James Ignatovic, playing with Anna Bright. And obviously they're going to go against Ben and Anna Lee. And I expect that to be a pretty competitive match, to be honest. I mean, that's hard to say when you're playing Ben and Anna Lee in a final on championship Sunday, best of five. But I think out of all the matchups I can think of that could make it a competitive match, this is one of them.
Yeah, definitely. And they got that little bit of connectivity from the Orlando Squeeze and MLP. And if Matt and Andre are great competitors, Andre and Anna are great competitors too.
Yep.
And I, you know what, Rob, I wonder, what is James Ignatowicz on the couch at home or wherever he may be? Who knows with that guy? Is he excited for his partners to get these wins, or is he like, man, maybe I'm not as good as I thought, as Andre just steps in last minute and gets to two championship Sundays with my partner? Kind of an interesting mental thing going on with him. And I'm slightly joking for one tournament, but I think that that's probably a thought process a handful of pros have had, is maybe they're just not quite getting where they want to, or even if they are, they ship their partner over to somebody and they have a better result than they had been having. Just a little tidbit there that I think some people think about.
Oh, dude. It's human nature. I'd be lying if I said I didn't think about it with Andre, right? It's like, you know, the last time Andre and I played, you know, J-Dub and Dylan, we lost 13-11 in the third, up 10-6 in the third. And then, you know, I'm watching Tardio and Andre, you know, losing three straight games to them. And I'm like, heh. And you fucked about with Declan in the past, I know. but then seeing Andre and Matt clean their clock, I'm like, well, I guess Matt's pretty good.
Yeah, Matt's pretty good. That's right.
Matt's pretty good.
Yeah, I've you mentioned it with Dekel as when we kind of had that breakup.
Like, you can't win without me. That can't
was
win
inevitable.
Without
yeah, and like the first couple tournaments, he did terrible, and I'm just like, let's go. And then he like won a couple or something. I'm like, okay, all right, whatever.
So
it's. I mean, people are people. This is the things people think about. And if you think, you know, that these guys are out here just smashing and dinking robotically, and aren't thinking about things like this, you gotta put it all together. And I'm a huge fan of just talking about the mental aspect. It's easy to talk about the physical, but the mental is what really makes these players well-rounded. And I think gets so many players wins when the physical skills are practically the same. So.
Yeah. And I think you'd be crazy to think that, that Andre, Matt, Anna aren't thinking about this stuff too. On the other, on the flip side of it.
Totally.
You know, you want to win out there. It's turned into, you know, winning above relationships and anything else. And, I don't know if that's still the vibe on the PPA necessarily, because I don't know what the deal is with prize money, or if there is no prize money, if you've signed the contract and you just have a salary, maybe it's a little less, motivation in terms of the money, but you still want to win.
We've already talked about a handful of the men's matches, so let's just touch on a couple other to kind of finish off that draw. And it's the only one that finished on Sunday, I believe that is the case.
Yep,
so
it is,
because the initial play on Saturday, the top half of the men's draw was further along than any other draw. So it makes sense that is the one that was finished yesterday. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we talked about how great Alshon and Navratil played. 11-4, 11-9, 11-4 for Andre and Matt Wright, which is a wild scoreline. And I'm really like what I'm seeing from Big H, the youngster, Hayden Patrickwin. He's been playing extremely well. Moved along into the quarterfinals with DJ Young. Couldn't get it done against the kids, Dylan and JW, in three games, 11-8 in the third. And then some pretty wild score lines for Federico and Pablo, who played great. I thought Pablo played awesome. He really, when he's playing well, he's got some stuff, man. He's got some great offense, some good counterattack ability. And, you know, I know that Fed definitely is the more stable of the two, but when Pablo plays well, that is when that team really takes off. So they were able to defeat Connor Garnett and Pat Smith 14-12, 11-8. And then, unfortunately, took a loss in the semifinals, 11-13, 12-10, 11-9 to Christian Alshon and Zane Navratil. So some pretty tight score lines. Mentioned the upset with the Johns. Pretty dang fun men's doubles draw.
Yeah, just kind of the last comment. Just in terms of strategy and things that I'm seeing that are becoming more commonplace than we'd see in the past. And you mentioned Pablo playing really well. And I think one thing Pablo's pretty much always done is tried to avoid that backhand dink and kind of move around it to hit a forehand, because he's got some nice weapons there. I think he feels more confident on the forehand side of the dink as well. But he can kind of pull that thing in line. He can pull it into your body. He's got some decent weapons on that side. And we're seeing the same thing with guys now on the left side, where off the bounce, you just have more weapons showing that forehand. So guys are running around, and I don't know if this is because people are seeing Jack Sock do it effectively, or if they're just seeing that, you know, it creates some more, it puts your opponents on their heels, you know, when you're showing forehand off the bounce. So I would expect that's a trend we're going to keep seeing more of. We're going to see guys work on that more, running around that backhand and looking to show forehand a lot more.
Yeah, as long as you have a certain baseline of athleticism, you're always going to get yourself in trouble occasionally when you run around. But, you know, when you're Thomas Wilson, Jack Sock, Pablo, Christian Alshon, it just doesn't really matter. You're not really giving up that much. So Pablo, great one-handed backhand out of the air. He does not have a lot of offense on the backhand side off the bounce. And he just whips through that lefty off the bounce, and he can put it into a variety of spots, like you said. So I expect more of this to happen. And there's just there's just not really guys like me anymore that are just plain vanilla skill sets. Like, almost all these guys move well and explode to the ball. And it's like some of the pitfalls and the things of being out of position that you used to see are just not as big of an issue for these guys with how well they move around the court. So I couldn't agree more.
Yep.
And let's see here. Moving on to men's singles. We'll just touch on this a little bit because, you know, we're doubles guys, Robert. So Federico Stakrud, I mean.
So crazy consistent, dude. It's insane. It's insane.
In the hardest and the deepest draw that we have of the five. And the dude just over
with the
and
most
over.
With the most variance, like yes, exactly. The most variance in results.
Exactly. I mean, it's wild, dude. I will continue to talk about how high his floor is, and in singles he has the rare high floor and the high ceiling, as he has all the shots, all the passes. The two-handed backhand has gotten better. The dude is just in fuego right now, and I just can't believe, given the state of men's singles, that he has made the final in every single event this year.
It's it's insanely impressive with how many guys are playing singles now and how many guys are good right out of the gate, and you see so many upsets. It's wildly impressive, and he's doing it to guys. Like, I think he beat like Schick 4-2. That's like the fastest guy on tour to beat him 4-2. It's insane, dude.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to, I mean, when he literally gets as many or more balls back than anyone else, to have that score line against a player like of Schick's caliber, I mean, just another reason to praise Mr. Stakrud and just being an absolute beast out there.
Impressive stuff.
All right, let's move on to mixed doubles, where Andre Daescu into the finals after a couple quality wins in the early and mid round, and then beat Viv and Thomas. You know, not a team that's just easy to. They've been playing so well, so explosive, and of course a very tight scoreline of 11-9, 11-9. But I think that you can see a bit of chemistry from that MLP play with the squeeze from Daescu and Anna Bright, because they didn't really need any time to ramp up. They were kind of just playing well right from the get go.
Yeah, and I think, dude, consistency still goes a long ways, you know? I mean, it shows you with Andre, like, not the most powerful player on tour, but I would, probably one of the most consistent, probably top three most consistent on the guy side, I would say. Just insane level of consistency and will to win, like we talked about. And, dude, like you mentioned earlier, between him and Anna Bright, just top, probably the top competitive, like top competitors in the mixed bracket for sure, I would say.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree more. And just look at some of these score lines here. These are, I'm not knocking the teams that lost. These are phenomenal teams. But Ben and Anna Lee, 11-0, 11-3 over Hunter and Paris. 6-6 over Hayden Patrickwin and Leah Jansen, who played amazing last weekend in Minnesota. And then beat Jesse Irvin and Christian Alshon 11-5, 11-4 after Jesse Irvin and Christian Alshon had beat the Johnson siblings 11-3, 11-9 the previous round. Just too good at the top half of the draw. And even though with those score lines being pretty clean for the one seeds, I still expect a pretty dang good mixed final later today. With Andre and Anna Bright, we'll just have to see.
Agreed. I think one of the, you mentioned the Johnsons moving to women's. There was an epic battle with Anna Lee and Catherine playing Georgia and Tina Pisnik, and I'll say it now. I think this is how I think like to think about players and how good they are. Like, if you have the clone of two players, would they beat the clone of another two players? I kind of like to think about that in some instances. And I think two Georgia Johnsons beat Anna Lee and Catherine conservatively 3 out of 10 times.
Okay. No, that's reasonable.
I would place a wager on the over on that.
And I would also say that I think a couple of those seven losses would be pretty bad.
Yeah, because
Georgia has that high risk, yep. high reward style. There's not a lot of margin in what she does, but man, when it is on, it is on. I mean, some yep. of the stuff that she can create, she's got those elbows in tight so she can cover her body and just kind of swat two-handers and forehands. And then she has, you know, elite raw power as well. So I think that I like what you did there. And I think that they could possibly beat them more than, you know, a couple different combinations of players. But there's probably going to be a couple 3-and-3s for Catherine and Anna Lee mixed in with the high risk, high reward she plays. But I agree. She has the tools to get it done. And if she ever finds that baseline of consistency, watch out for her.
Yeah, I think just the kind of the what would you call it? The main factor in that is that Georgia can match their power. I think Georgia's got the most power in the women's game. Quick, like incredibly quick hands too. Very similar to J-Dub in terms of short stroke, but man, it comes off hot. And I think Georgia's able to match hands of Anna Lee and Catherine. Just in terms of this match, though, it was 11-8 in the third. It was an incredible battle. You had Tina playing the left most often, which obviously I think that's Georgia's stronger side too. So the issue you run into with that team is neither are very confident on the right, not where they necessarily want to be. They both play there and mixed, but at the same time, it's not where they're best suited. But Tina was incredibly solid, made a lot of balls. Always has good resets. I think what she lacked a little bit is kind of the counter power, like we talked about with Georgia. Like she ball is coming back hot off Georgia's paddle. I think Tina's not. She's countering one hand on that backhand, and it's kind of a slice, so it stays up a little bit. She's not able to get over it. So I think if she can develop into like more of a 2-y, where she's cracking the counter back, she's going to be super dangerous. But yeah, I mean, like we talked about, Adam, it's. I'm not bored of watching players and teams try to be Anna Lee. That's what I find exciting. I don't find the dominance necessarily boring on that side, because I think Anna Lee, like you see the fire. Like she doesn't want to lose. You see the fire if, you know, going into a third game, like she's, you feel the emotion, like more so than the Johns, right? They're just like, blah, 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 blah. But Anna Lee, she's like, you know, she's respecting the players and she thinks they're, quality high-end players, and she's competing hard, which is what I think makes it fun to watch players and teams try to beat them.
Yeah, no, she's a stud, and love Catherine, such a well-rounded quality player. But I think that Catherine's you could also talk about Anna Bright possibly, you know, as that number two slot, whoever you want to put there. The gap's pretty significant with how amazing Anna Lee is, and I think there's, you know, a handful of guys kind of just nipping at the heels. They're not there yet, and maybe not even super close, but that gap between Anna Lee and the next lady is pretty significant. She's a freak out there and very impressive. So I couldn't agree more. Let's see here. Okay, nice little run here from Etta Wright and Megan Dazan, who are clearly playing great. They snuck away 12-10 in the third against Vivian David and Lacey Schneeman. And then ended up taking a loss to Anna Bright and Rachel Rohrabacher, who we might see that matchup quite a bit throughout the year, as they are, arrow up, especially Rohrabacher with kind of the small amount of time that she's been playing. I think she's probably getting better at a quicker pace than any of those four players. So if she can take a step forward, you know, we might have a back and forth affair, even though, you know, that's clearly going to be tough when her opponent is Anna Lee Waters.
Yeah, no, 100%. So that'll be a fun match to watch. Women's singles, we have a fun one. We've got Caitlin Christian, mm-hmm. Who's been playing a long time and always been very good at singles, playing Judit Castillo. So we're going to have, and I think this Judit said this is her first championship Sunday at a PPA. So super exciting for her. And I think it's probably Caitlin's too. So yeah, it's going to be exciting.
I think that's right. Caitlin Christian surviving in the quarterfinals against Buckner, 9-11, 11-9, 11-9, and then a solid win against Paris Todd, 11-3 smooth in the first game, but 12-10 in the second. And yeah, I mean, this I mean, this literally, we were talking about it earlier. It's just the absolute perfect scoreline for Georgia Johnson against Catherine Parento. 11-0, 0-11, 11-5, which is a great win for Georgia, but it just kind of captures her volatility out there. And yeah, congratulations to what I believe is two first championship Sundays for the ladies in the finals, Judith Castillo and Caitlin Christian. It's pretty darn good championship Monday. Hopefully the little one gives me a little break and I can check some of it out. But it should be a fun day.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on Catherine and singles?
I think she's an amazing, well-rounded player, like I always say, but she is not the tallest, and I wouldn't say elite power is her calling card in terms of passing shot. She has the rolls and some of the cross-court passes are amazing, but I think a bit of reach at the kitchen line and then some possible lack of power from the back of the court makes her a bit more vulnerable, even though she's not going to give you anything. You're going to have to earn it against her. But, you know, these are the things in singles that we have to talk about and have to discuss, especially on the women's side with, you know, some of that court coverage at the kitchen line. And the thing is, it's not just the court coverage. These ladies have incredible passing shots. They all can roll the backhand with topspin. They can drive through the court and they can create that spin, as I just mentioned. So if you're 5'6", 5'7", and you're dealing with an opponent that has amazing passes, that's a lot to overcome up at the kitchen line. And, you know, we see that kind of pop up in some of these matchups.
And if we look at the two players that have had Catherine's number, it's Salome more recently and Georgia, who are both very heavy hitters. They hit heavy flat balls. They kind of hit through the court, very different than Catherine, who, like you said, has amazing rolls, amazing, touch and angles, but doesn't hit heavy, heavy through the court like they do. So I think contrasting styles there, it's leaning towards the heavy hitters. But again, I think Catherine's been so consistent for so long that I don't think this is a new normal necessarily. I think we're going to see Catherine in a ton of championship Sundays moving forward, and she's a competitor and she fights hard and she's going to try to solve for it, right? So she's going to adjust and try to get better.
Yeah, agree completely. But I mean, I always relate this to myself just because it's the best way to relay the information. Like I was consistent. I made a lot of balls. But if a certain player with a certain skill set played well, there's just not a lot I could do to counteract that. And if they didn't play well, I had a great shot and I got a lot of wins that way. But if a certain skill set plays a certain way, there's just not much I could do. It was a bit overwhelming from a power and reach and athleticism perspective at times. So, you know, not that that's some of the same issues for Catherine. She's a much better mover and much better athlete than me, but just kind of how I relate it and kind of to convey that info. So I think that was the last bracket.
That's there. The PPA Austin right there. It was a good, good event, better event if it'd be indoors, but hey, we can't always get that. but speaking of indoors, you got a mixed bag this weekend. You got the APP Miami, which is at the Miami Beach Convention Center. On a spring break weekend with a big music festival in town, it's going to be pretty chaotic down there, I'm guessing. Miami Beach Convention Center is literally right in Miami Beach, close to South Beach. Going to be very crowded for spring break. That's going to be interesting. I'm not heading down there. I'm going to stay at home and rehabbing and getting stronger. But I will be obviously tuning in. We got some fun matchups. We got J-Dub Dill down there. Got Gabe and Andre down there. So it's going to be, it's going to be a blast to tune in. But yeah, we can go over some of those results next week, Adam.
Sounds good. I think this, man, we just got a lot to say. We're over an hour every time here, Robert. So,
well, our intro was 45 minutes. So, hey.
yeah, it was. And I'm going to make sure I get this in. I'm going to talk a little commentary next week. Have just a little mini rant about, you know, some stuff that goes on in the commentary booth and just maybe some things that people don't know some of the trials and tribulations of being out there. I know these keyboard warriors love to rip on everyone in the public eye, and that's part of the deal when you're a player or a commentator. But I'm going to get a little more in depth on that next week. So I think that that's a good topic to talk about, and I think it would be of interest to at least some people. So
100%.
Lovely episode, sir. Looking forward to next week.
Likewise. Till next time, like, subscribe, and let us know your thoughts on everything we talked about today, including the strategy and what you thought was the key differentiator in the Zayn Christian match versus the Johns. Would love to hear your thoughts. And until next week, talk then. This is It Feels Right with Rob and Stone.